Blog Talk Radio.
Sonic effects. Just to please to exchange a few ideas to catch our breath. It's been a hectic week for the world, isn't it? It's just the way I've been looking at it this week. It is as it always has been. Things unfold, the connectedness of the universe and all that, our place in it, our sense of priority, that changes as we go along, doesn't it? It's one of those quirky little things about living that the world is what it is, but we age. And we're not really sure what that entails, but we can find metaphor that helps us. And if you intend to be a bit of the romantic, you might like to think of ourselves as mellowing like a fine wine. I kind of like that. Sometimes we might break up the cork. Sometimes we might not have properly stored it. Sometimes it might just slip out of our hands and crash at our feet. But repeated effort tells us that and teaches us things. There's no standard out there that we have to, nothing we have to. We must leap over. It's not as if life is a series of hurdles, unless we're trying to make a point and that's part of the proposition. It is what it is. It is what you make of it. If you're prone to anxiety, and which many people are, I don't know if it's any more than it ever was, but I think we're more courageous talking about these things. What to do? Because you know darn well it will affect your thinking, your sense of judgment, umbrage. You find yourself flying off the handle at the least provocation. And then in your private moment, wondering why you keep doing that. Or do you notice that when you're being the alpha male, that it's off-putting for the people in the room? Do you think, or have you explored that side of your character, that empathy? It's not horrible. It's interesting. Because when we do these things, we still have some sense of gain in our mind that somehow I'm going to say something that's going to be leaving me with a feeling that I've gained something, whether it's some mastery over the idea, this sense of rightness, mm-hmm. that I need a feed on that. Well, you know, if we examine where that came from, what's it do to your sensibility about the world around? There is that place in our thinking between what is right, what's ethical, what's unethical, and what is understood. What is, and somewhere in there, what is the reality of the situation? Well, I don't think we have to search very far for the meat of the conversation. You know, it's present around us. If we go there, well, why would we go there? I can find some intoxicant to take my mind away. I can find something to distract me. If I think of intoxication as a distraction, I can find lots of ways of doing that. But there are some things that enrich, and not because of the word, but because of the deed. So there's some things that allow us to acquire an understanding of ourselves and the world around us. If I think about what is perhaps most important for the likes of me, it would be the printing press, because I was able to read the books that you wrote and share your thinking and your experience of the world around, and add that, not to replace my own, but to add that to my repertoire. There were times when I needed to escape from pain, from unpleasantness, from uncertainty. Times when unexpected, always tragedy. And times when I felt very cynical, seeing or knowing things were going to happen and feeling I could do nothing about it. You know that feeling. And your work, your essay, your poem, your novels, helped me gain perspective to feel in some way in my thinking that I'm never alone. Yeah, when you're, you know, a bit more sophomoric, you think that about this notion of original thought. Oh my goodness, nothing that's going through my head is original, except it's happening for you for the first time, and in that state there is some sense of originality. But to actually look at and define who you are, with that question, you're beginning to define yourself as an individual. You begin to realize how much we have in common with people around us. Thank goodness. We are that kind of social critter. But lo and behold, we have something that allows us to feel comfortable within our own skin. And we begin to change our perspective that we can be quite comfortable with our own thinking. We can be satisfied with less. What an unusual thought. Do you remember the first time that was put to you? How is it possible? I have to be satisfied with bigger, more, better. The indulgences need to be constant. There's no limit to them. I need, whether it's consumerism, acquisition, comparing myself with the neighbors, that's kind of a norm, isn't it? Understanding class structure and economics as much as anybody who understands these things. Getting a leg up by the work that you produced. And the beauty of print is that it lasts. It lasts. I can read a sonnet, but my perspective on it changes. If I read material now at this age, that reread material that I read as a young man, it's fascinating that some of it seems so new and some yet familiar. But the depth of meaning is just this very, very interesting experience. You realize some people are quite capable of doing this at a younger age, and you and I as well, but to credit ourselves for this. And then to be confident enough to never claim that you're in charge. We live in a world that really does teach people that control is possible, and though it isn't. You don't control the circumstance of your birth. You don't control what other people think of you. You don't control what the fates bring, probability. You don't control that. But somehow we want to believe that we have control. Funny little creatures we are in that way. We keep doing it, although the evidence tells us otherwise. But maybe it is simply the admission of that, making this order that we belong to valuable. Maybe that is, in a way, the value that it offers each one of us. We may not be the scholar that Aristotle or Socrates or Plato, but we can assume that we are in that class, that small group of men following him, following them around, asking questions, listening to the questions and the rebuttals of other people, the brave soul that will challenge because they're hoping to draw out more meaning from the master. Well, you and I can do that. You can do that in a way that organizes our thinking. It's reasonable to think how that sense of control, what do you control? You control your mindset. You control your thinking. The rest, no, haven't seen it. And I don't any longer indulge people by saying, but you go ahead and think that if you will. And I don't do that anymore because that's wasteful. And it never, ever leads to any benefit that I've seen. We wrestle with these ideas. We struggle with them. Damn those philosophers for passing this on to us. Mouth to ear, mind to pen, pen to print, print to book, book to me. Common language, lingua franca. Hey? With our small group, we have some things that there is a language that we need to understand so that we can speak with one another. And it's not about whether we're using Greek or French or German or Russian. It doesn't matter. There's a common language. Those are translations of this common language. We speak, we understand that, so we have, we make that link. It's like hospitality in a way. When men are talking about it, I don't know if we become, I've been in crowds where men are so self-conscious they can't admit they actually pull on their socks, you know, pretentious and self-conscious. Oh my goodness, yes, you've been there. I'm talking about the kind of men that have a little confidence. You know, my mother used to make up biscuits that were, and we never tasted his mother's biscuits, but we tasted our own mother's biscuits. We connect. We do it joyfully. And then we, if we've been taught to respect the comfort level of people around. In other words, if we've been taught to be aware of the impact that we have on other people, hopefully that's happened when we're little, because if it doesn't happen or it hasn't happened, young men that are walking around with those conceits in their mind are just insufferable bores. Oh, you know, well, being taught that they're an insufferable bore at a little age, at 10 years old, is much, much wiser, much more productive. If he gets all pouty and goes to prove that he isn't, well, fine, you know, that's personality emerging and another another waste, you know. But the beacon that somebody talked about, that flame, maybe it wasn't just the Hindi that saw God in the flame, you know. But somebody talked about that purity of light, and made an emotional and spiritual connection with the darn thing. And then went on to, when science was emerging, well, it's like ideas today. There's great ideas that are happening around the globe each and every day, but it doesn't mean everyone absorbs every beautiful idea. There's a period of concern and distress, particularly around the innovation. You know, as we've talked about before, we're not good with innovation. Not good with that. It's cause for suspicion. Oh, those automobiles will never, ever, ever replace the horse. No. Because I can tie my team to the wagon, and I know that I'm going to get to town. Those machines could easily break down. That electric starter will never, ever replace the crank. No. And putting on a battery, you know, it's added cost. And then we come along with these incredibly novel ideas of a world in which there is that, we reach that state of redistribution and not with the grinding loss of hope, ambition, and self-development purpose. We've experienced earlier experiments. These experiments have been going on for a long, long time. Experiments where we're trying to think about quality of life for everyone. That's a big step. Of course, the way that we get there is by experimenting. Most often they fall apart because they are experiments. They're not proven theory. They're hypothesis. And then the rest of us can point fingers at the failure as a reason not to continue with the thinking. Yeah, we're like that. Because it's self-serving to do that. Self-serving. And it somehow it feels healthy when a room full of people are telling you, you must have an enemy. You know, you have to be on your guard all the time. And the only way to do that is by having the bigger weapon. Well, if that worked, we wouldn't be in the state we are in, because that kind of thinking has always failed. The faster arrow, the bigger barrel, you know. Never, you know, we can annihilate 100,000 people in one bomb. I don't know how in the hell you brag about something like that, but it doesn't stop anything. We are left with the thoughts that give us balance. If we're dreary all the time, we know that that is draining. But on the other hand, there's these, you know, people that just revel in the gravity of situations. Just revel in it. It doesn't pull on them the way it does on me and you. There are people that run from catastrophe and people that don't run, and people that are doing it because it's the right thing to do to help. And then there are others that are waiting for the penny to drop afterwards. When the catastrophe is over, and people aren't sleeping well, when these nightmares keep coming back, their thoughts become looser, and their emotion becomes so unstable. Helpful then to have a framework, a philosophical framework. What can you change in your thinking? What can you control? Well, we control the way we look at things, the way we experience things. And the rest, it's interesting. It's interesting. It's neither good or bad, because it doesn't go away. It's like there's a good mathematic formula and a bad one, a good calculus and a bad calculus. I don't know that. I don't know that. You'll have to help. I don't think it's so foolish that some of us find satisfaction and reinforcement for those ideas in the way, in the music, in the poetry. At whatever age you are, you open your mind, your thoughts become quite fluid, and you become receptive to reading and seeing the world through the eyes of someone else. It's a hard thing to learn. It's a hard thing to learn. So we can expose ourselves to samples of it. What in the world do they mean? You know, quality of anything. What in the world are people talking about? Shades of gray. But, you know, it is what it is. I can see it there. The light shines on it. The light doesn't shine on it. I know for certain. Yeah. The kind of people never seem to have played a game of chess or Go, have they? No. Sometimes I think that life it does require a bit of strategic thinking from time to time. Here, we're going to test your mettle. We're going to share. We're going to look over the shoulder of the authors and see the world through the eyes of these other men and women who've written the songs and performed them for us and shared what they've noticed of the world in their poetry and essay. And we are going to do it not so much on purpose. It's like, you know, trying to interpret why you're going to like a glass of wine with your meal. Well, ugh, why would you do that then? Enjoy it. You know, but nothing worse than some pious drogue talking about, you know the type when this beautiful meal has been prepared for them, and all of a sudden they feel this need to be pious. Oh, I've cut out salt, actually, and I don't eat that red meat material. No, somehow I'm feeling superior. Not only that, but somehow I need to tell you so that you'll understand and elevate me in your thinking. Pratt, just shut up and enjoy. Enjoy other people enjoying the moment. Yeah? I know. We have some very, very interesting music today. God, I was thinking about a very dear man. He told me he's from Prague. He's a charming man. I immediately thought, why would anybody ever leave that city? But here, just something we haven't done before. Just, I think, not enough. I'm going to share with you some what they're doing with jazz in Prague. I was just gobsmacked. This is George Mraz and George and Camilla. It's a trio. It's called Blues for Sarka. Just sit back, relax, fill up your cup with your favorite, and enjoy. Thank you.
Say yes to a whole new generation of Civic.
See what happens when you hit the wrong key. See what happens? You hit the wrong key. You touch the wrong button. Ads pop up. My goodness. I was just going to say the music was just so delicate, so wonderful. We'll certainly be visiting that trio again. They've captured it, haven't they? Too much clutter on my little desk here. The topic today, the commentary, is I've called Struggle On. I was reading some work by Thomas Carlyle, and this came from that. It's funny. Huh? There is much to be gained from the presumptions and conclusions drawn from our aspect as a Mason. Listen to the way we challenge inequality where we find it. Watch as we attempt to balance opinion with influences. And as we do this, stress lines develop, again, sending us off on a lonely orbit while the world decides our fate. No utopian dream. This reality is fraught. If we weren't thinking philosophically yesterday, existential threat will soon make that de rigueur. Still, we don't remanufacture character or, for that matter, thinking. We influence those among us who have presence of mind enough to experiment with the potential of declaring yourself a relic with the voice of a polymath. Thank you, Mr. Prescott, for providing a public school education in the classical style. We walk slowly away from universities, Al-Azhar, Ruperto Carola, Bologna, Salamanca, Paris, Padua, Naples, Federico, Coimbra, perhaps for the confidence instilled in us as auditors of all that we see and experience. Freemasonry gave us reason to pull up to the chessboard with friends we didn't need to be convinced of the value it contained. We knew the transparency of awareness made us impossible to threaten, impossible to control. We became the embodiment of a values-based world organization, a significant threat to despots and oligarchs. So we kept in our lane as inextinguishable influence, kept in a benign wrapper so as to calm our critics. And today, there we remain. We couldn't scale up the order as we wished, but we had to try to see if it were possible. So now we have information that we are prudently putting to use. And as I reckon, we are witnessing a resurgence on an almost imperceptible but honest scale. A resurgence. As long as we trust and value knowledge, we will continue the struggle with all the grace we can muster. Long live. Long live Freemasonry. Eh? Thank you. Just amazing. Sometimes my brain and hands just don't work together. That's Carol Ruzicka, the jazz musician from Czechoslovakia, Czech Republic. Fantastic music. Fantastic. I want to share with you. Try to share with you the work of a poet named Thomas Campbell. And the work is the Pleasures of Hope. But to do that, he's a Scottish poet, late 18th, early 19th century kind of guy, president of the Clarence Club, for those who are, and the Literary Association of the Friends of Poland. Lots going on in Poland, music and art. But to get to him, I want to talk about the motive for his work by another poet by the name of Samuel Rogers. He was born in the same period. He's an English poet. And while he was, you know, it was not somebody that I've heard of before, but for obvious reasons, he was, during his life, he was very popular and well-received. But as he lived on, his work was overshadowed in a way by the work that I often read into the program, Wordsworth, Coleridge, and Byron, the Romantics. So this guy sort of, you know, fortunately for us, as we look back, we work to help us. He was an interesting guy. He lived in London, if you can imagine. Good life, artistic, literary life. And he was writing poetry, but interesting that he made his money as a banker and an art collector. Not something we usually associate with the poet. The reason I'm getting into that is that he wrote a poem in 1792 called the Pleasures of Memory. And it's in two parts. And this was the introduction of a poem and an essay, I will say. He did an ode on superstition, but even before that. But as the title implies, his poem was inspired by Pleasures of Imagination, written in 1744 by another poet by the name of Mark Akinsides. And there is an argument for much more than Akinsides is content to drift away from the easy flow of associations into the resembling the Thomas Warton's work, Pleasures of Melancholy. So the themes, you see, pleasures of imagination, pleasures of memory, pleasures of melancholy, these were themes that prompted or inspired other writers. And so it was first published anonymously, and it only 250 copies, but the Pleasures of Memory made the author a household name. So this work, Pleasures of Hope, is derived from this. Yeah. Thomas Campbell. So we'll keep Rogers. We'll get around to Rogers in the subsequent show. A very, very popular poem So it plays on the theme of Rogers, the pleasures of memory, and on that I've explained. But it established a format through a series of poems on the pleasures that would adopt for a generation to come. And the sentimental scenes described by Campbell often resemble those of Rogers' poem, the martial, inspiring tone of the pleasures of hope is naturally very different from the calm characterized by its original. And as Campbell puts it, triumph not, ye peace-enamored few. Fire, nature, genius never dwelt with you. The first part of the poem, Pleasures of Hope, consists largely of a descriptive catalog of the triumph of hope over the misery variously suffered by inhabitants of Europe and America, Africa, and Asia. And in the second part, following the pattern of Rogers' poem, it's concerned with hope in relation to imagined objects, books of fiction, and history. So I can't possibly fit it all in today, but I'll read just the first two stanzas, then some pieces from the middle, and then the last stanza, hoping that it will whet your appetite and your curiosity to look into it a little more, because it deserves that kind of, I think, it deserves that kind of moment of pause. Poor child of danger, nursling in the storm. Yeah. Here. At summer's eve, starts hopeful. At summer eve, ethereal bow spans with bright arch the glittering hills below. Look at the stars. Why, mountains turns the musing eye, whose sun-bright summit mingles with the sky. Why do these cliffs of shadowy tint appear more sweet than all the landscape small and near? 'Tis distance lends enchantment to the view and robes the mountain in its azure hue. Thus with delight we linger to survey the promised joys of life's unmeasured way. Thus from afar each dim discovered scene more pleasing seems than all the past hath been, and every form that fancy can repair in dark oblivion glows divinely there. Primeval hope, the Ionian muses say, when man and nature mourned their first decay, when every form of death, every woe shot from malignant stars to earth below, when murder bared his arm and rampant war yoked the wagons of her iron car, when peace and mercy banished from the plain sprung on the viewless winds to heaven again, all forsook the friendless guilty mind, but hope, the charmer, lingered still behind. Poor child of danger, nursling of the storm, sad are the woes that wreck thy manly form. Rocks and waves and winds, the shattered bark delay. Thy heart is sad, thy home is far away. It is an essay. As I do for you guys. Eternal hope, when yonder sphere is sublime, peal their first notes to sound the march of time. Thy youth began, but not to decay, locked in fire the realms of ether glow and heaven's last. Below, thou undismayed shall own thy torches, nature's funeral pile. Inspire thought, rapture, yet be the tears of love for thee. discussions of semantics. That's sensibility, but still it's remarkable. Genius and not essentials. As if I can't remember the last time I sat down with a good friend in a nice restaurant for dinner and jumped into concerns about trade embargoes. No, it's the mindset. How are you? You know, nice place. Have you ordered yet? No. Sorry, I'm late. The history that we're getting into here is kind of interesting. I think it works if you approach it a bit reflective. This is talking about the time, you know, sort of the 1760s in Europe and the impact on us. And yet the historian is telling us something that is sort of a story. It is a story inside of a story, a tale, a revelation. And she makes reference to a fellow, John Wilkes, and he was a journalist and a reformer. And at around that period, there was quite a bit of concern about the responsibility for the utter and abject poverty that many people were living, the starvation, the degradation of the human condition, and the class structure got into it, and it was difficult. So the writers kept the themes in front of the public eye, and not always popular by the establishment. And you and I have said it, oh, that person's just a troublemaker. You know, they're agitating, but if we begin, my goodness, we begin to take them seriously, that's a different study, isn't it? And here the author writes, the social turmoil caused in the 1760s by Wilkes and his followers, not a few of whom were Freemasons, sent the Masonic leadership scrambling to the lecterns to remind the faithful that perfection within the lodge requires order and stability. In 1763, Thomas Edmunds, Esquire, addressed his fellow Masons in the old and prestigious Horn Tavern Lodge, to which Montesquieu had once belonged, in case name-dropping is important to you. Here, he praised his brothers for standing above the turbulent disquietudes and vitiated principles of most of the unselected and uncivilized part of mankind. 2 years later in Taunton, John Whitmarsh reminded brothers that there are two grand pillars of the Masonic art, its professed design to promote civilization and adorn human life with every scientific and moral accomplishment. To achieve these goals, however, the Freemason must honor God and King and be subordinate to his superiors. In the same decade, a Masonic orator in Newcastle assured his listeners that riot and disorder cannot correct errors that arise in government. In 1764, an anonymous Grand Master lecturing near Birmingham admitted that in all the ages of the world, we find a record of unruly members of every state grasping at power to which their virtues or abilities were by no means equal, and to which often overthrew the Constitution they attempted to defend. This observation affords a moral lesson to members of private societies, as well as kingdoms and states. He asserted, however, that Masons have ever made faith to the government. In 1764, the Reverend Davenport, also lecturing in Birmingham, warned Masons to be careful whom they admit to the society. There was never a time when our fences needed to be more strictly guarded. It is not accidental that these sermons were given in a city where Wilkite agitation was particularly intense. Yet in that same sermon, and almost as if safe concession must be made to the ideal of equality, the Reverend Davenport called for the admission of women into the lodges, or at least for the creation of lodges for women, which existed, he claimed, in Germany and France. Indeed, the very sermons from this later period, which exalt order and hierarchy, also most clearly demonstrate the tensions inevitably produced by Masonic idealism with its utopian vision of equality and harmony for all, and the need to preserve the status quo. In an anonymous oration of 1772, demanding that Freemasons never poison their minds with Republican principles, nevertheless warns of the dangers of corruption in a language that clearly implies the need for some kind of reform. When the law is dispensed with that pleasure, when it is pressed against its true intention into the service of prerogative on the one hand or privilege on the other, when magistrates are put into office to serve a party by the partial administration of it, in a word, when an honest cause is overturned by artifice, the torturing of witnesses, the disguising of truth, then the law loses its nature and efficacy. This speaker is sure, he says, that these abuses would never happen in England. Even in the day. And we're talking along the lanes of reason, purpose. We do this today. And so we part company again for a short time. See, the idea of subordination is interesting. That's certainly changed over the years. I tend to be known as a rationalist. Subordination, it requires more than authority, because if the authority doesn't make sense in the context, then it has no meaning, no bearing on me. It means that I am Cyril's grandson. A good man doesn't need a policeman to tell him how to act properly. I don't know, maybe I was 7 years old when he told me that. It's true. Many of the beliefs that I was taught have been put to the challenge and changed. The lines, the thinking of Masonry from 18th and 19th century, a lot of it, where it dips, the commentators are dipping into, the philosophies that embrace the idea of good life. You have to think or entertain the idea that what they're saying is stability and obedience of some form is necessary for our cultures, for our communities to live with turmoil, without chaos, to live in a particular order and to accept that status quo. Fine, accept that status quo based on some principle. because I'm in a position of power. So I can appoint husbands who are granted to them. But today, we have such advantages because we can look back and we have the history. And many of you will have a character at your fingertips. You have those big gaps in deception. They fill it with information and information, of course, in opinion. And through that, we sift out the facts, what really happened. And then when I get to examine from the comfort of our psychological, what is in fact best for a man. We'll dip into this again next time we're together. Thank you very much for your tolerance today. The technical glitches, unless you leave me with a keyboard and a cluttered desk. You're rushing through too much due to think of the generosity that you deserve. For you, we'll talk about the thing in the next show, but then nobody can challenge your ability who we're situated in. Take care of yourselves. See you again soon. Random kindness.